And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now are world-renowned photographers Beverly and Peter Pickford. Together, they have traveled the globe in search of the Earth's last wild places, and they've documented this in an unprecedented quest of a book called Wild Land. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today.
It's really our pleasure. It's wonderful to be on your show, Claire. Thank you for having us.
And you are joining us today, you said, from South Africa, correct?
That's correct. We're on the west coast of South Africa, just north of Cape Town.
Well, Peter and Beverly, you have such an impressive breadth of work, and you have put so much beauty on pages and brought them to life for all of us. I'm curious as to how this passion for photography and the land started. I'd like to hear from both of you, if you don't mind, a little bit of your origin story of how you began your photographic journeys.
That is a very long story, Claire. I think we'll have to price it in the extreme, but it all started when we were very young. Bev and I met when we were young. I was on my way back to university and complaining that I actually really wasn't happy about the course I was doing. She asked me, well, what do you really want to do? I stopped the car and thought, well, that's a very important question. And I answered it truthfully and turned around and went home and did something completely different with my life.
When did you first pick up a camera and realize that there was something special about that? Or when did you know that this was going to take you on the journey of a lifetime?
I've always loved photography. My dad was a keen photographer, and I kind of picked it up from him. So right from school days, I was interested in photography. And once we started working in the wilderness, I found more and more enjoyment in taking pictures. And when I started to show them to people, I found that they were impressed. So I decided maybe we should give it a go. Maybe we should really try and do it as a profession. It's a hard field to get into, but if that many people were liking it. So Beverly actually supported me for the first 2 years of my working solely on wildlife photography and making a book called Wilderness Dawning. And when we showed it to publishers, they absolutely loved it. And since then, it's been one book after the next. I think we're on book number 12 at this point.
Peter admitted that he worked as a journalist. He decided that that would be a really good training. So because you basically get sent out with an assignment, and by that afternoon, you have to be back and deliver. And then you have to print it in the darkroom and deliver it come hell or high water. And I think that was very good discipline and training for him. And then obviously his calling to the bush when he turned the car around and decided that would be where his heart was. He went to Wilderness Leadership School, and it was almost a natural progression, wouldn't you say? To pick up a camera out in the bush, because you were seeing things that you just felt needed recording.
Yes. And if you have this innate draw to this, then you are so equipped to help tell stories in a visual fashion. And it seems like it was inside of you all along. It just needed to be tapped.
I think that's definitely the case. Both of us love the expression that one can find in particularly stills photography. A lot of people ask us why we never switch to video. But I think that stills photography just attracts us more strongly because there's so much you can say by capturing a moment. With a movie, you're telling a story. With a stills photograph, you're saying something that can last forever.
Right, and you've captured that moment in time. So you started this around 1987 is when you had that first release. Is that correct?
The first book came out in 1987. Obviously, we started work on that quite a bit before that. But
sure.
Yes.
Sure. So you then embark on several different photographic journeys. What planted the seed for this idea to create this book called Wildland, where you go to the world's most undiscovered places? Maybe that seed was always there and you just needed time to nurture it and grow it. But when did the idea for this book start?
I think it's exactly as you said. It was a natural progression to something where we realized that during our lifetime, the wilderness areas that we knew were disappearing. They were becoming infringed on, both threatened, growing smaller. There were a lot of endangered wildlife out there. And so we felt we needed to go and see for ourselves, to travel the world, to go to each continent and find a place that we could use as an example of wilderness that still remained intact, and then seek protection or added protection or awareness from people that this is what we need to do. Certain places need to be set aside, left alone by development and human infringement for our own well-being, and obviously the well-being of everything that survives there.
And so you went to all seven continents. How did you decide or even define the places that would be considered to be on the pages of this book?
Before we lived here on the coast, we lived up in the mountains at the back end of the wine country in the Cape in South Africa. And we had a house very high up in the mountains in a remote place. And we looked out over this very vast valley in the United States, you'd say miles, so hundreds of miles wide. And the view was very long. And we were really struggling to find where we might find these unrestrained wilderness areas. We weren't just looking for something like a national park. We wanted the land to include people, just to have the scope that was vast and that was unfettered and uncontained. Obviously, if land is wild and there's few people there, when you start doing research as to where it is, the research gets thinner and thinner as you get closer and closer to the heart of your subject, because no one goes there. And so we were just really struggling to find out exactly where we should be including. And we were sitting discussing this after dinner. We were sitting down by our fireside. We had all the lights off and we were looking out of the window from this mountain house across the valley. And it hit me like a lightning bolt. I could see lights where there were people. We then just basically turned to a map of the world at nighttime, and where it was dark, it was wild.
So you discover these places on the map that seemingly are not producing any light. So there's seemingly just a wildness to it. And then from there, it seems like you might even need to whittle that down as well, because mapping this out seems like that would be the biggest feat, to know what areas to go to and when, because some I'd imagine would be nearly impossible to get to at certain times of year. So how did you work through where you were going to go and when, and how long did that take?
We used Google Earth at night, and that is where we found the light. And we chose one area per continent, because obviously we had limited budgets and limited time, and everybody has a favorite place, which was quite interesting, because as soon as we discussed our project with people, they would immediately say, oh, you absolutely have to go here. And a lot of the time that was where we were planning to go, but a lot of the time it wasn't. But we also were looking for contiguous wildland, because obviously national parks and protected land is wild, but we wanted areas where outside of the national park or outside those borders, it continued to be wild. And if people existed in those areas, they were in association with the land rather than in domination. So traditional people, subsistence people living from subsistence hunting, where basically they weren't changing the landscape, but they were living in it, then we would include those areas and those people.
And I think to expand a bit on your question, we obviously sometimes in the hemispheres where it's really cold, the upper and lower latitudes of the earth, in the wintertime, it's almost impossible to go to work anyway. So we tried to choose spring, summer, autumn through the places that we went to. And we went for as long as we could, 6 months if we could, 5 months usually, but we took our own vehicle with no schedule, no preset dates or anything. We just went and explored. And so when we got to the edge of the land where it started becoming industrialized or commercialized or agriculturalized, we would turn around and head back into the country that we knew was wild. And we explored it that way. So we went mostly when the weather was reasonably favorable, particularly obviously the polar regions, the Arctic and the Antarctic in their respective winters are almost impossible to visit. And as you move away from them, so it is less and less difficult until in the tropics you can visit at any time. We explored as far as we could with what time we had, but we did give ourselves a lot of time.
Yeah, how many years did it take you to go to all seven continents and get this content?
It took us 5 years in the field, 5 years of working.
Wow.
In the field.
We went away quite constantly. We came back a few times, but there was one period we were away for a year and a half. If we could go from one area to the next, that was obviously preferable. But if we couldn't because of climate, then we would come back. We obviously went to the Arctic and Antarctica on ships.
And you said you took your own vehicle, so you would ship your vehicle as well?
Yeah, we shipped a vehicle around the world. We have a very robust 4x4 camper, which is specifically made for long-distance off-road work. You know, we have enough water to last us 2 or 3 weeks. We can carry food for 2 months. It's specifically designed for being away from civilization for long periods.
And would you say that in trekking the globe and seeing these places, was it hopeful? Was it heartbreaking? It was probably both. Can you share with me some of the feelings or emotions that you went through?
I would say it was definitely both. There is never enough wild land. I mean, that is pretty much where we are at this stage and as the human race. But there was definitely hope. And there's also, amongst Indigenous people, there is a lot that one can learn from them in the way that they are able to be on the land and yet not change it and not threaten all other life that is there. And I think that that is an incredible thing to learn. I mean, right now, what's happening in the Amazon with deforestation, with the mining all over the world, with pollution of rivers, you find if you move to where the Indigenous people are defending their land, there is a lot of hope in the way that they are doing it, that it is possible, and it is possible for us to turn around and not actually develop every last square inch of the planet. It is possible for us. There is so much information to draw on which can guide us as to what we need to leave alone for the health of our planet. But obviously, on a daily basis, when one drives into a wilderness and there's wildlife and everything seems perfect, then one would stumble on an enormous mine or an oil rig or place of mining. And then your heart would just sink and you'd think, oh my gosh, another place that has turned, you know, that we've lost. And, you know, but then you'd meet a community that was fighting to keep their river pristine and keep the wild fish running up the rivers, and other people who were turning from constant overfishing to tourism and guiding. Costa Rica is a fantastic example of that. So yes, definitely both.
When you close your eyes, is there one particular image that sits with you or has a story attached to it that will just forever stay with you?
Oh, it's difficult. I really like, there's an image of an Elephant in the Desert in Namibia in the book, a lone young elephant bull crossing the desert. And I knew just what it took to get that photograph, the amount of time that we had to move through the desert looking for elephant tracks to finally find the tracks to track the elephants for days. And then once we found them, to actually get them to accept our presence to the point where they were comfortable. You know, the desert elephants are actually very wild and very wary of humans. They've had bad experiences with humans in the deserts of Africa. So, yeah, that particular image, it's a special one for me.
Yeah, I think that in the Arctic, we came, it was Monaco Glacier, and the kittiwakes, they were absolutely in their hundreds, maybe thousands, but obviously in one image, one couldn't get more than a few hundred. But it was an absolutely, there was obviously an upwelling, a cold water upwelling that was bringing the krill to the surface, and the kittiwakes were just flocking in their hundreds and feeding and joyous and free. And the image just, I think that has stayed with me. And for me, it symbolized what we were looking for in terms of wildland, something irreplaceable, something spectacular, and something we possibly can't even think about losing.
When people look through the pages of your book, what is it that you hope they will feel or take away?
First of all, I really hope that they don't turn the pages. I hope that the images are sufficiently arresting that you want to spend time with each one. That's really what I was talking about right in the beginning, is that with stills imagery, we can say something that is ambiguous even whilst being powerful. I want it to mean something to me, something different to you, and something different to everybody. We want it to give you pause so that by the time you've finished reading it, let's say it takes you a week or so, that you have a very, very strong sense of the natural world, of what is wild that is left in the world, and how potent its presence can be.
And you, Beverly.
We've chosen images where we have searched for the environments which will tell the story. And then after we found the environment, we seek out the subject. We seek out an animal moving through or swimming through or a herd moving through to tell the story of the place rather than portraiture. I mean, obviously, we have some portraits because they can be very arresting and also they give pace to the story. But essentially, it was seeking out those environments. And that's what we hope that people would recognize, is it's the landscape, it's the land that we attach ourselves to. The animals are all part of that and they are in harmony with that. And I think that is the story that we wanted to convey.
And you've also created a book called Wild Ocean. Did your process with Wildland help inform the creation of this next book?
Wild Ocean was just published at the end of last year. It came out in late October, November of 2025. So it was the natural progression, really, from Wildland. Wildland was extremely well received throughout the world. It sold out everywhere that it was published. And on the strength of that, we were wanting to embellish the idea and the project. And so it was a natural progression to start looking at the ocean and find what parts of the ocean and the world's coasts still remain wild and wilderness. And so Wild Ocean took 4 years in the making.
It was urgent. You know, at the time, wild land was everything that consumed us, was a disappearing wilderness. And basically, we need to go and reinstate the fact that we are protecting wild land. And then, but everybody was talking about the ocean and how our oceans are becoming so overfished, overpolluted, overutilized, and everything. And we just felt, oh my gosh, it's urgent. We need to get out there and find areas that are still pristine, find those marine protected areas, and we need to work on creating more. And for both projects, we actually donate our images to NGOs that are for wildland, creating national parks and protected areas and conservancies, and for wild ocean, for marine protected areas around the world. Because there are many NGOs working on this right now. It's, you know, if we want to save 30% of our ocean by 2030, we've got a lot of work to do.
Well, the undertaking of Wild Ocean, I'd imagine, was an incredible task, given the subjects of the photos and the depths in which you go. Like right now, I'm looking at a spectacular image from Micro Indonesia. What did the preparation and work look like to capture these images?
It was a very steep learning curve for us, Claire. When we decided that Wild Ocean should be the next project, then we realized that we would have to principally be working in or on or around underneath the water. So we changed a lot of our camera gear to underwater camera gear. We went into in depth in learning how to scuba dive and to photograph underwater. So it was, we spent, oh, I would say 6 or 8 months just in preparation for ourselves to be fully prepared for the work underwater. And yeah, it was much more challenging in that we had to rely on a lot of people. We were no longer able to just drive ourselves around and find what we were looking for. We had to rely on a lot of people for information on the oceans, where they thought we should be working. And then to access these places, a lot of them are so remote that you can only get there by boat, or, and if you want to get into the water and under the water, then you have to be on a boat. So the logistics and the work for the book was very different to that of Wildland. We had to rely a lot more on other people and working with and off vessels.
We became a team, really. We didn't have a fixed team because our budget didn't allow that. It would have been marvelous, but it was still the two of us, but we worked with incredible dive masters and skippers and guides. So for each area that we chose, ultimately it was the same difficulty, but for each area we chose, we researched it very in depth and took a lot of advice from people who had been there. And then we chose to go at the best time with the best visibility, and then we had incredible support. Mm-hmm. That's how it was possible.
And what is the best way for our listeners to find out more about you and your books? Can you share with us your website?
The current website, it's a new one. We've just named it after the two latest books. So it's wildlandwildocean.com. And the very best place to get our books is usually online these days. And both books are available at the moment. Wildland sold out, but we've just produced a second edition of it to complement the publication of Wild Ocean.
I loved that you said you hoped people wouldn't just flip through the pages of these books, but really sit with the images, because these books really do, they require time and you need that to take them in fully. And the images are truly remarkable. They're impactful and do make you ponder and gain a better understanding of how glorious the earth is and the creatures that inhabit it. So after producing these labor-intensive works, are you taking a moment to relax, or are you preparing to embark on another journey?
The plan was to relax, but we just got offered a book we can't refuse, so.
Yeah, I think we can't talk too much about it, but it is another ocean book, and it's about a wild ocean project.
It's about creatures in the ocean. So.
Yeah, so endangered creatures in the oceans. So, I think it's all being formulated at the moment, but for us, it's very exciting and very urgent. And so I guess having a sabbatical will have to wait.
Wow. Okay. Well, we look forward to seeing this new work, and we wish truly you all the best as you keep covering the planet in the way that you are and allowing for us to be a part of that. I really do feel so honored to have had this time to speak with you both. The books are Wild Land and Wild Ocean, and you can learn more at wildlandwildocean.com. Thank you so much, Peter and Beverly Pickford, for sharing these moments with us on This Green Earth. It has been such a pleasure.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on the show.